You're listening to an episode of a Wondery Plus exclusive series. To continue listening, join Wondery Plus and enjoy ad-free listening to over 40,000 episodes, early access to your favorite podcasts, and more. Find Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
It's June 1, 2010, in Los Angeles, California. A swanky resort beside the Pacific Ocean with lush green lawns and swaying palm trees. Inside the luxurious main hotel building, Steve Jobs, the co-founder and CEO of Apple, is on stage at the Wall Street Journal's All Things Digital Conference, a select gathering of the tech industry's top CEOs and executives. He's wearing his trademark faded Levi's and a black polo neck shirt. He's sitting in a cherry red executive chair across from two famous tech journalists, The Wall Street Journal's Walt Mossberg and Kara Swisher. Swisher starts with a question to Jobs. How do you feel about your relationship with Google? Eric Schmidt, their CEO, was on your board. Well, they decided to compete with us. We didn't go into the search business. The conversation is friendly, but the journalists are trying to get Jobs to reveal his plans and strategy at Apple, particularly how he feels about Google recently entering the smartphone market.
You just woke up one morning and discovered they were competing with you?
Yeah.
Did he call you?
No, they started competing with us and got more and more serious.
Do you feel betrayed? Are you gonna...
My sex life is pretty good. How's yours? Mossberg gets it. Jobs considers his plans to fight Google off limits. So the journalist tries a different tactic, asking Jobs about a startup Apple bought a month before.
Last year at this conference, we had a small search startup called Siri.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I would call Siri a search company.
You now own them, right?
Yeah. There was lots of expectation, and this company is in the search area.
No, they're not in the search area. They're in the AI area.
Jobs goes suddenly quiet. AI, artificial intelligence.
You bought them for their engineers and their patents and their knowledge about AI.
Mm-hmm. That mm-hmm is Jobs' way of saying he's said all he's willing to say.
We like what they do a lot.
And that is that. The conversation moves on. Jobs could have explained that he'd paid more than $200 million to buy Siri, or that it had spun out of a Pentagon artificial intelligence research program that was the largest AI project in the history of the United States. Jobs might have shared that his plans for Siri would deliver on a concept developed at Apple 25 years earlier, a concept that would redefine how we interact with computers. But he never spoke in any detail about Siri in public ever again. 16 months later, Scott Forstall, an Apple senior VP, unveils that little thing Mossberg called a search device. It's the beta version of Siri, incorporated into their iPhone 4S. He begins by asking Siri the weather forecast. Apple employees and journalists packing the auditorium marvel as Siri quickly returns an accurate response. But then Forstall throws Siri a curveball, a conceptual question.
Siri, do I need a raincoat today?
I don't believe it's raining.
Not only did it understand the words I said, it understands the meaning.
He demonstrates how Siri can set an alarm, find nearby restaurants, schedule meetings, answer text messages, and even crack a joke.
Who are you?
I'm Siri, your virtual assistant.
One chair is empty, reserved for the visionary behind AI and a phone. He's 13 miles away, so sick he can't get out of bed. The day after Apple reveals Siri to the world, Steve Jobs dies at home, surrounded by his family. Apple's founder will never see how Siri and other software like Amazon's Alexa and Google Assistant will drive millions of people to talk to their machines like they're talking to a friend. And have those machines talk back.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
From Wondery, I'm Steven Johnson, and this is American Innovations. In this series, we look at some of the most important innovations of the past 100 years. From the personal computer to nuclear power, these innovations have totally changed the world and our lives. We're going to explore the people behind those innovations, their challenges, their mistakes, their accomplishments, and how their imaginative thinking and persistent efforts had an impact on every one of us in ways you may never have thought of. Siri, are you real?
I'm an assistant. That's all that matters.
Siri, are you human?
That's a rather personal question.
These next episodes are about the rise of artificial intelligence and the quest to breathe intellectual life into computers. This is episode 1 of Thinking Machines. Thanks to smartphones and apps like Apple's Siri and Amazon's Alexa, artificial intelligence is no longer just a futuristic device in sci-fi movies. And it's set to get much more powerful because technology companies and governments are investing heavily in making smarter machines. Machines that can reason, create, predict the future, even dream. Already today, we're seeing massive leaps in what is now being called machine learning. This is the idea that we don't just program machines with facts and numbers like we used to, but we program them to learn and evolve and grow from experience. Where will this take us? The long-term impact of artificial intelligence is something I've been thinking about a lot lately. Human and machine decision-making is the subject of my new book, out September 4th. It's called Farsighted: How We Make the Decisions That Matter the Most. In later episodes, we'll explore some of the most controversial applications of AI, both their potential benefits and the potential threats they pose. But in order to understand where AI might take humanity, you need to understand where it came from. Artificial intelligence has developed very much through a push-pull competition between machines and the humans who build them. Scientists and engineers push themselves to build what seem like impossibly intelligent machines, much smarter than have ever come before. And then, when the machine beats them at whatever they've been programmed for, the humans build an even smarter one, which can do even more. Today, we're at a tipping point. So let's meet the Mavericks, who first dreamed of a world where machines would not only process vast quantities of data, but were capable of intelligence greater than the people who created it. And what better way for smart machines and their creators to face off in a battle of wits than by playing games? It's 1956, and in a small lab on the campus at Dartmouth, a chess game is in full swing. Pawn to e4. Pawn to e5. John McCarthy has been a chess enthusiast his whole life. He's a 31-year-old math professor with a thick shock of dark hair that fans over his head. He's known for the intensity he brings to everything he does, from studying the cerebral mechanisms of human behavior to the way he plays chess. Right now, he's in deep concentration.
Knight to f3, okay. Pawn to d6.
Planning to use your bishop to take my pawn, I see. Except he can't see anything. Both McCarthy and his opponent are wearing blindfolds. Every move they make has to be in their heads. It's the kind of mental exercise you might expect a group of scientists studying intelligence to play at summer camp, which is kind of where they are. McCarthy's opponent is one of the 8 researchers who have shown up at McCarthy's invitation for an 8-week conference on the campus of Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. It's summertime. Most of the students are away on vacation. Outside the window, the stately elm trees on the rural campus are in bloom. McCarthy has given these researchers some modest goals. Make machines use language, be creative, and improve themselves. And he's optimistic. He believes they will achieve a significant advance by the end of the summer. He's also given this area of research a name: artificial intelligence. The chess games are fun, but they have a serious point. You see, it's the perfect testbed for the idea that computers could do something that looked like thinking. And that's checkmate. Can I take off my blindfold? Yes. Oh, that's what the board looked like. I'd completely forgotten about that knight. Playing chess with a blindfold is pretty hard for a person, but McCarthy wants to go one step further. Teach a machine to play chess. Earlier in the 1950s, the English computer scientist Alan Turing had suggested chess playing as a sort of test for artificial intelligence, a way to see if the machines really were as smart as their human creators. McCarthy stands up from the board and shakes hands with his opponent. Another researcher, a young, balding man with bright eyes, approaches him with a sly smile.
Playing chess again, John? Why, you want to play another game, Marvin?
Marvin Minsky co-organized this conference. He's as driven as McCarthy. They haven't worked closely together before, but this will be the start of a long and fruitful collaboration. They share a love of math, provocative thinking, and the belief that intelligence can be artificially created inside a machine. Minsky, a Harvard fellow at the time, is driven by an insatiable curiosity. He's incredibly talented, not just at math. He's also a brilliant musician and can improvise Baroque fugues on the piano. One of his students would later say, "I have come to know a lot of geniuses, but Marvin is the only genius I know who is so smart it's scary." Not yet 30, Minsky has already made numerous advances in math, physics, psychology, and electronics.
You know, John, I really believe most people overcomplicate things. The brain is a meat machine. We've just got to determine how to build something that functions the same way using electronics. And what do you intend your artificial meat machine to do?
When I get back to Princeton, I'm going to try and build a machine that can develop a model of its own surroundings, an artificial mental map. A bit like my mental map of the chessboard. Actually, quite like it. And the next stage would be having it use that map to come up with different solutions to problems that we present to it.
That would look a lot like creative thinking.
Exactly. It would be several decades before the attendees of the Dartmouth Summer Research Project realized they were part of an historic event, a first of its kind. But at the time, McCarthy judged it a failure. The blindfold chess games and his conversations with Minsky were great, but it wasn't the leap forward he'd been hoping for. He thought by bringing 9 brilliant minds together, the group would come up with a plan to put human intelligence into a computer. But the other scientists seemed more interested in pursuing their own individual projects than in teaming up. And so McCarthy shrugs his shoulders and gets on with his work. But his goal of getting researchers to work exclusively on artificial intelligence doesn't go away. Eventually, he winds up at Harvard, where he meets up with Minsky again. And the two begin to hatch a plan. It's 1958, 2 years after the Dartmouth conference.
Do you think he'll go for it?
Only one way to find out. But I did hear they had some unused research funds lying around. Could be our big chance. John McCarthy and Marvin Minsky are both at MIT now.
McCarthy had been drawn by the prospect of ready access to a powerful, room-filling IBM computer. At the time, computers were huge and very expensive. They were also kind of a mystery. The war had shown that computers could be useful for jobs like making calculations to aim artillery and interpreting radar signals. But now, they want to do something new, something big.
Come in.
John, Marvin, how are things? Jacob Weisner is the head of the Electronics Research Lab at MIT. McCarthy gets right to the point. Marvin and I want to have an artificial intelligence laboratory, Weisner. Weisner leans back in his chair. All right, what do you need?
Well, we need a room and a secretary and a key punch to make punch cards for the computer. Oh, and two programmers.
Weisner thinks for a moment. A smile dances across his face. And how about six graduate students? MIT has just signed a joint services contract. You know, Army, Navy, and Air Force. We've shared it out as best we can, but we've got six students we don't know what to do with. I don't know what your, what was it, artificial intelligence lab is going to do, but it's just solved my problem. MIT's new AI lab would quickly become the leading center of AI research. Minsky and McCarthy managed to draw in some of MIT's brightest grad students. They're more determined than ever to make progress on intelligent machines. The lab attracts a motley crew of technology enthusiasts who see working with computers as fun, not work. Many of them come from MIT's Model Railroad Club, where members had started to use the term hacker to describe someone with a spark for getting computers and electronics to do things they weren't designed to do. A group led by Alan Kotok stay up all night working on a chess program. But every move takes the computer 15 to 20 minutes. At this rate, they'll be lucky to finish a game by this time next year. When McCarthy's students graduate, putting the project on hold, the program has completed fragments of four games. They haven't figured out how to program for the end game, the finale of a chess match, where the remaining pieces try to checkmate the king. But they still estimate that the computer's play is comparable to an amateur with 100 games experience. As the lab continues to grow, both Minsky and McCarthy become convinced that language and common sense are key to making machines as smart as humans. But McCarthy is ready to move on. And in 1962...
Hello? Is that John McCarthy?
It's Stanford University calling.
Yes. I just spoke to the department heads here, and it looks like you'll get what you're asking for.
It's an offer McCarthy can't refuse. A raise and a chance to start a lab of his own. Plus, he's tired of the cold winters in Massachusetts. He immediately accepts. Before long, he'll accept another challenge. One that threatens to pull him and artificial intelligence into the Cold War. American Innovations is brought to you in part by Wix.com. You can showcase your bright ideas and innovations with Wix. They've developed artificial design intelligence that creates a stunning website for you. And now you can create your website right from your phone, which means you can open up your online store, portfolio, blog, wherever you are, even while listening to this podcast. Here's what you do. Go to Wix.com, decide what you need a website for, pick your style, add your own images, and just like that, your website is ready. Seriously, it's that easy. You'll look amazing on every device, desktop and mobile, and it takes less than 5 minutes. If only everything in life could be so simple. Great innovators can change the world, but first, the world has to know about you. So what are you waiting for? It's time to get started. Go to Wix.com, that is Wix.com, and create your very own beautiful professional website today.
When it comes to hiring, don't go searching for the one. Just meet your match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
It's 1965. In the foothills above Stanford University, on the edge of Palo Alto, sits an odd semicircular building with ore-like protrusions sprouting from the roof. This is the Stanford Artificial Intelligence Lab, or SAIL. Inside, John McCarthy and a merry band of grad students are working towards a dream of a world populated by thinking machines. Everything from speech recognition to robotics. They also have the cash to back up the vision, thanks to the Department of Defense. The U.S. had lagged behind the Soviets on the space race, and President Eisenhower was determined not to fall behind in another new field. The Pentagon bought into the vision of McCarthy, Minsky, and the other AI pioneers early. Now, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, is footing the development bill, funding projects that aim to expand science and technology. The press is excited, too. Predictions of the imminent arrival of machine intelligence are glowingly reported, with all the optimism of people who don't know anything about what it will take to get there. But no one minds. It's an exciting time to be a nerd, especially at Stanford.
Hey, Prof, I heard you were taking off for a few weeks. Where are you going? Moscow. There's this lecture I'm giving about the chess program I worked on at MIT. Kotak McCarthy? I always thought the program should be called McCarthy Kotak, but hey, what do I know? Moscow. Do you speak any Russian? Duh.
McCarthy is the perfect leader for the Stanford lab, because he's not really a leader. He lets people do their own thing. The counterculture is blossoming in Northern California, and John is all in. He's got long hair and a headband. Here, no one much cares if you doze through lunchtime meetings because you work through the night to get more precious computer time. In fact, move right in. The attic has been turned into free housing for grad students who work at the lab. They spent hours playing Space War, the first video game ever created. Feel like relaxing? Maybe a little exercise to unkink your neck from all that sitting at your desk? There's a sauna in the basement and a volleyball court right outside, a precursor to the kind of perks tech giants will provide their employees in Silicon Valley 40 years later. McCarthy is unconventional and innovative, and he's not the only one. His students and colleagues are a mix of MIT's early hacker culture, crossbred with the free spirit of Northern California and Silicon Valley entrepreneurialism. Rooms are named after places in The Lord of the Rings. The coffee room is called the Prancing Pony Tavern. The computer room is Mordor. McCarthy grabs his bags and heads for Moscow.
До свидания. See you all in a few weeks.
Once he's there, John McCarthy strides onto the expansive grounds of an historic 19th century estate toward a building with four imposing white pillars. This is the Institute of Theoretical and Experimental Physics, run by the equally imposing Alexander Kronrode.
Alexander, good to see you again. John, always good to see you.
While Russia may not have computers as powerful as those in the U.S. or Europe, Kronrode is ahead of his time. A brilliant mathematician and computer scientist, he employs women at the Institute because he believes women are more accurate in certain tasks than men. The Institute is more somber than the freewheeling hacker atmosphere at Stanford, but he and McCarthy are a lot alike in their forward thinking. Both are driven by a profound interest in making machines intelligent. Kronrode convinced the department heads to purchase an M20 computer, and the team is finally making some progress. But he still considers the Kotak McCarthy chess program the best in the U.S., and chess the first step to creating thinking machines. The Drosophila of artificial intelligence is how he refers to computer chess programming. Drosophila is the Latin for fruit fly, and fruit flies were key in the first steps of scientists understanding genetics. In other words, computer chess provides the start of understanding artificial intelligence. If a program performs badly, it provides information about human mental processes that had not been identified. McCarthy's program isn't perfect, but he's made a few improvements on it since working on it with Alan Kotuk back in his MIT days. Now he has come to Moscow to give a lecture about his program. And in 1965, there are still only a handful of programs that are capable of playing the game at all. Cronrod considers McCarthy's one of the few that play credibly. After his talk, the Russians hold a champagne reception for their American guest. And Cronrod wastes no time in making him a proposition, one that McCarthy immediately grasps.
Professor McCarthy, thank you for traveling so far to bring us this lecture. Your chess-playing program is very interesting. But you know, it's not unique in the world. We here in Russia have our own chess-playing program. So I've heard. We are now using the M20 computer. I had to fight for that one. And we are still justifying the expense with the department. Not everyone understands why we're up all night. We've renovated the attic in our lab. The guys just sleep up there, if they sleep. But we still have a long way to go. I bet we could learn a lot if our programs could play each other. That would be a first. Exactly my thoughts. It would give us a lot more information to work with. We can send telegrams stating our moves. It's gonna be a long game, but well worth it. May the best program and programmers win. McCarthy is no cold warrior. He taught himself Russian in his 20s and was good enough to translate mathematical texts into English. The match he proposed on his trip to Moscow threatened to pull the obscure world of AI research into one of the Cold War's most tense contests. Chess had become the perfect proxy for the standoff between the US and the USSR. The psychology, deception, and war metaphors were irresistible. International chess tournaments had become geopolitical events, and things were going the USSR's way. The Soviet state saw the chessboard as a level playing field where it could prove the superiority of socialist ideology without the imbalances of wealth or military hardware. Thanks to heavy investment in chess talent programs after the war, the world chess champion had been from the USSR every year since 1948. Would computer chess be any different? It's here, the latest telegram. 3 years later, and the American and Soviet chess programs have been battling in slow motion for 9 months, and the USA is losing. The internet doesn't yet exist, and so moves are exchanged by international telegram. They have mostly brought bad news to McCarthy students, punching in the latest moves from Moscow into Sale's computer and sending back its responses. Do you want to open this one? I don't. I know we're only down 0-1, but those first two games that ended as draws made it clear that their program is stronger than ours, even though our computer is much faster. We can't possibly win this last game. I think they upgraded the program before the last game, too. The way its pawns surged forward like that. And I think it's looking further ahead than it was before. Whenever our guy, our program, screws up, it always notices. Okay, give it here. If we get this done, we can play some Space War before lunch. Rook to A1. Let's see that on the board. Oh, well, that's it. They'll checkmate in two moves from there. First Sputnik, and now this. Who's going to call the White House? I doubt President Johnson even knows what a computer is. But who's going to tell McCarthy? While both programs blundered frequently, everyone agrees that the Stanford chess moves are some of the worst. And in the end, the final score is 3-1. Maybe McCarthy is stung by the defeat, or maybe he doesn't care. Either way, he starts to pay less and less attention to chess. There are other projects at the lab that are taking off. Artificial intelligence is about breathing intellectual life into machines. It really is a marvel to see how technology is becoming increasingly capable of anticipating our needs. One part of our lives where it pays to have our needs anticipated? Home security. I'm a big fan of SimpliSafe home security because SimpliSafe is ready for anything that gets thrown at it. If a storm takes out your power, SimpliSafe is ready. An intruder cuts your phone line?
SimpliSafe is ready. Say they destroy your keypad or siren. SimpliSafe will still get you the help you need. That's what makes this home security system so great. It's always ready. SimpliSafe could cost an arm and a leg, but it doesn't. Instead, they only charge you what's fair. 24/7 professional security monitoring is just $14.99 a month. There are no contracts and no hidden fees. I recommend SimpliSafe to everyone I know because I know how great it feels to know my home is protected. To get started, go to simplisafe.com/innovations today. That's simplisafe.com/innovations to protect your home and family today. simplisafe.com/innovations. By 1968, the lab has made some huge leaps forward. Now it's a wacky and wonderful incubator of AI ideas for computer and math geniuses who dream of one day building a fully intelligent machine. At this exact moment, a young man with long red sideburns and a drooping mustache is talking to a robot. He holds a microphone to his lips. Pick up the big block at the right side. Did you get that? A man holding a 16mm camera peeks out from behind his viewfinder. He's been given the job of making a film to showcase the work Sale has been doing. I'll come back for it. I was focusing on the robot arm. Several feet away, a thin robotic arm attached to a primitive-looking monitor hovers over a scattered group of blocks in various sizes. So is it going to do something? There's a delay. It takes 20 seconds after my command. Sometimes 30 until it's completely done. Oh, wait, there it goes. Let me get the shot. Two pincher-like fingers firmly grasp a large yellow block in the group. And then the machine shakily pivots left and sets it down 2 feet away. Unreal. It's actually picking up the block. Groovy. What do you call this? I don't know, man. A computer-controlled robot arm that operates by human voice control? It's part of the hand-eye-ear program. It'd be better if it had a name, like Stumpy or Hans. I guess. Just get the shot, clown. This is just one of the programs McCarthy is overseeing as part of the lab. To get the robot arm to understand the command, the team begins working with speech recognition. Analyzing speech waveforms requires breaking down words into ever smaller linguistic units to create rules that the computer can follow. Up. Down, left, right. They come up against some pretty major challenges. For a start, we don't all speak the same, and not everyone speaks as clearly. What use is a computer that can only understand one person at a time? Then there are all those little quirks of language that we don't even think about, but that could really throw a machine. A computer can't read between the lines to figure out what a person means. It has to be taught the connection between different ideas. One way is to have the computer create its own connections between different, apparently unrelated, ideas. If the computer doesn't know that there's a connection between, say, bad weather and a raincoat, or choking and not being able to breathe, then it won't provide an appropriate response. The team at Sale have been hard at work coding rules for all these kinds of problems. In the end, they have more than 75,000 words of code. A robot arm that responds to commands is just the first step. Sale was created with the goal of building a fully intelligent machine within a decade, and McCarthy really believes it will happen. He's left chess behind, but the lab is still a playful place. In the fall of 1972, flyers go up around the Stanford campus. What is this? The first intergalactic Space War Olympics will be held here Wednesday, 19th of October, 10 o'clock. First prize will be a year's subscription to Rolling Stone. The gala event will be reported by Stone sports reporter Stuart Brand and photographed by Annie Leibovitz. Free beer! Free beer sounds good. Might be fun to watch an intergalactic space war. Stuart Brand, the founder of Hippie Handbook, The Whole Earth Catalog, writes up the event for Rolling Stone, calling it the most buzz-buzz-busy scene I've been around since Mary Prankster acid tests. At Sale, the line between playing and working is completely blurred, and it seems like they are progressing by leaps and bounds every day. The lab members called themselves sailors. Late-night video game sessions weren't the only thing about the future of computing that Sale got right first. Since his days at MIT, McCarthy had been obsessed with an idea he called interactive computing, the idea that you could sit at a computer and have it respond to your input in real time. That concept seems mundane today. Most of us have an interactive computer in our pocket. But that's only because McCarthy's work and ideas were so influential. When he began his career, computers had to be loaded with a problem or program and then left alone while they crunched through to an answer. McCarthy wanted to be able to have a dialogue with the computer, adding new input as it worked and allowing man and machine to become partners who work together. When this idea seeped out of Stanford, it would help Silicon Valley change the world. And two of the people to do that would come to Sale on March 19, 1975. It's 7 p.m. McCarthy welcomes a group of young hobbyists called the Homebrew Computer Club, enthusiasts trying to build their own computers at home or in their garage. This is their second meeting. Two friends are among the group, one stocky 25-year-old with a beard and shoulder-length hair, the other 20, lean with an intense stare. As McCarthy describes a world where everyone has access to computers, they sit entranced in the front row, soaking it in. I guess you guys, you researchers and professors, are doing math and stuff with your terminals. What about the other people, like the secretaries? Well, we've found if you give someone interactive access to a computer, they inevitably find it useful no matter what they do. Anyone can benefit. So for instance, with a simple command, they can see a list of names of everyone who is currently connected to the computer. That way they don't need to go hunting around the building to know if someone is at their desk. And there's another command that lets them view recent Newswire articles from AP. The lean kid is clearly impressed. Now it's the stocky kid's turn to raise his hand. That all sounds great, but does the hardware have to be so big? McCarthy smiles. The idea of smaller computers for individuals to use seems like a long way off. He and his fellow sailors look down on the Homebrew Computer Club and their fascination with machines small enough for a lone hobbyist to build and maintain by themselves. The Homebrew Computer Club never returns to McCarthy's lab, but the visit leaves a mark on the two kids in the front row. Their names are Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak. And roughly 1 year after visiting Sale, they will found a computer company called Apple. It was one of many seeds that McCarthy would plant over the course of his career. McCarthy doesn't work much more on chess. He spends his time at the lab working on robotics and other AI projects, including a self-driving cart that is able to follow lane markings. But McCarthy's demonstration that chess programs could play productively against each other inspired many others to make chess programs of their own. Before long, computer chess contests became a fixture of AI research. McCarthy predicted that computers wouldn't always be stuck playing in an inferior league of their own. Back in 1968, McCarthy had lost a friendly chess game to Scottish master David Levy. Chess masters are players that have reached the highest level of the game. They're the best of the best.
Well done, David. Always a pleasure, John. I do think your computer program is getting better. You really think you can beat me one day? Without sounding too brash, I believe my program will beat you within the decade. Sounds like a bet.
The two agree on a 500-pound bet. Over the next 10 years, Levy excels in outfoxing a series of progressively smarter chess programs. In Toronto, in 1978, he beat software from Northwestern called Chess 4.7 and collected his winnings from McCarthy. Man was still smarter than machine. That same year, a fiercely talented 14-year-old from Baku, Azerbaijan, became the youngest player to reach the finals of the Soviet Chess Championship. His name was Garry Kasparov. He didn't know it yet, but he was destined to become the most dominant chess player in history, and he would be forever identified
with the moment chess computers overtook humans as the best players on the planet. He's the subject of our next episode.
Right now, the issues raised by artificial intelligence can seem interesting, but not exactly momentous. Can virtual assistants like Siri become more conversational? And if so, should they announce themselves as bots if you happen to be on a phone call with them? But long term, AI is likely to be one of the most transformative technologies of the 21st century. Many people believe we will ultimately be better off if we allow future intelligent machines to help us make important decisions, determine jail sentences, for instance, or economic policy. Other people think that future super intelligent machines may one day pose an existential threat to humanity.
A big part of the spread of ideas comes from great infrastructure. Advances in communication and technology means that you can instantly connect with anyone. But that also means that anyone can connect with you, and you have no way of vetting them. And now, if you're hiring, you can see what makes ZipRecruiter different and try it for free. That's right, free. Find your next great hire with ZipRecruiter. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/AI to see it for yourself. That's ZipRecruiter.com/AI. One more time, that's ZipRecruiter.com/AI. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And a quick note about these historical recreations you've been hearing. In most cases, we can't know exactly what was said. Those scenes are dramatizations, but they're based on real historical research. American Innovations is hosted by me, Stephen Johnson. For more information on my new book, Farsighted, How We Make the Decisions That Matter Most, you can visit my website at stephenberlinjohnson.com. There's also information there about my upcoming book tour. Sound design on this episode is by Spoke Media. This episode is written by Tom Simonite. The producer is George Lavender, with editing by Stephanie Jens. Executive produced by Marshall Louie for Wondery.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.